Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology with its sleek mid-cut silhouette. It's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome, tennis fans, to KickServeRadio.com 2024, part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, featuring International Tennis Hall of Famer, former world number one, Mats Wilander, and Texas Longhorn all-time great, two-time All-American Johnny Levine. Your host of KickServeRadio.com is Andy Zoden. So, take it away, AZ.
And take it away, I will. Welcome, everybody. KickServeRadio.com, part of Tennis Channel Podcast Network, and it is an exciting time for a couple of reasons. A, we are in the thick of it. It is the clay court season, and we've got one of the best clay quarters of all time. Of course, I speak of the great Mats Wilander and Johnny Levine, a great clay quarter in his own right. The three of us are together. It's been a long time. Boys, I'm excited to be in the presence of both of you. Very exciting time as we move into the clay court season. Mats, before the clay court season gets off and running too fast, we do start in Monte Carlo. So great tournament. First of all, I'll ask, how many times did you win that one?
Andy and John, great to be with you guys. Monte Carlo, I won twice. I beat Mel Purcell in 1983.
Oh, that's right.
And Jimmy Arias in 1987. Lost in a couple of finals, I believe. Alberto Mancini, Argentinian, and Henrik Sundström, a Swedish guy. But yeah, great tournament. Obviously, with Stefanos Tsitsipas having won it three times now, he qualifies there with I think Bjorn Borg won it three, Ilie Nastase, and of course, Rafael Nadal. I don't know how many times he won it. But Stefanos Tsitsipas, I mean, the only thing that this tells me is that Stefanos Tsitsipas is a very natural clay court player, and he doesn't really need time to start playing clay court tennis, because in my eyes, he plays clay court tennis on all the different surfaces, and he's just better on clay with that one-handed backhand, has a little more time. But yeah, great tournament and great timing, because we've been missing Stefanos Tsitsipas. I have winning tournaments and being at the end of tournaments. So I thought it was a great start to the clay court season.
Who one-handers back in the top 10 in the world. That's the best part for me, watching Grigor Dimitrov break into the top 10, making the finals of Miami, and now Stefanos Tsitsipas with that win. And he earned it to get there. Had to get by Jannik Sinner in that semifinal, and had to get by Casper Ruud, who had taken out Novak Djokovic in the semi. Okay, another big clay court final, Johnny, that we had, and you probably had special enjoyment in this because it featured two Americans, and it's always nice to see the Americans do well on clay, even if it is on American soil. And in the U.S. clay courts at River Oaks in Houston, you had a Ben Shelton Francis Tiafoe final, which Shelton would win 6-3 in the third. Is this promising for the young Ben Shelton to get that clay court win before he goes to Europe, that big game of his can translate into big wins on the dirt?
Here's Johnny.
Oh, absolutely, Andy. By the way, it's great to be with you guys. Mats, it's been a while. Andy, I have to say that Ben Shelton winning his first title on clay is a huge, huge victory for him in a lot of senses. I mean, the confidence that he can play on all surfaces. I mean, we know he's going to be tremendous on grass. He's already amazing on hard court. And so now you look at the clay court, he wins. It's a little different clay, I think, than Europe. But nevertheless, I mean, he beat some really good players. He beat Echeverry, who's a great clay courter from Argentina. He hung in there, and now he's sitting as the number one American in the country, ahead of Tommy Paul, ahead of Taylor Fritz. And this is just the start of what's going to be a brilliant career.
Okay, so I have a trivia question for you guys. First, I have a statement, because in 1992, Ben Shelton's father, Brian, won this very same title. And my wife was asking me, is that unusual for a father and a son to win the same professional singles tournament. And I thought, oh, no, it has to have happened several. I couldn't think of one.
Better research next time, buddy.
I started thinking back, and I'm like, who would have done what the Sheltons did with Brian winning the U.S. Clay Courts at River Oaks? I don't guess it was the U.S. Clay Courts at River Oaks. It was probably the WCT River Oaks in those days, probably, Matt.
Yeah.
Brian Shelton wins it then. Ben Shelton wins it this year. Can you think? I mean, did the Ruse, did Christian and Casper Ruud both win? Who else would have even? Phil Dent and Taylor Dent. Who could have been potentially in the ballpark for doing that?
I think Taylor and Phil Dent, maybe. I mean, they play kind of similar.
Right.
I would have thought that maybe there's a grass court tournament out there that both of them won at some point. You know, Fred and Sandon Stahl always
comes a good one. Yeah.
In my mind, even though Sandon wasn't as good a singles player as he was a doubles player, but I'm not really sure, to be honest. Okay. And the interesting thing is that Brian Shelton wasn't really a clay court player. He was more of a serve and volley guy that was coming to the net. But can I ask a question to both of you about Ben Shelton? Because to me, him winning, it tells me that he can play tennis in many different ways. You watch Francis Tiafoe, that backhand is going to be the same backhand on grass, on hard courts, and on clay. Very little topspin. Ben Shelton, I think, has these options to play a forehand similar to Rafael Nadal on a clay court with an enormous amount of spin. And I think he can do the same thing on the backhand, or he can take it early and flatten them out. The serve is going to be an absolute nightmare on clay, maybe more so than other surfaces because of the spin. But I think he is going to be a dark horse at the French Open. Can't go all the way, most probably, but certainly a guy that nobody wants to play in the fourth round of the quarters.
Well, I'll answer that and just by saying, does any lefty in this day and age not walk out onto a clay court saying to themselves, WWRD, what would Rafa do? You know, and then therefore just try to channel their inner Rafa to the best of their ability. And if he's got time, I would think that Ben Shelton could turn his forehand and try to, you know, sort of convert it into something Rafa-esque. I don't know. Rafa would certainly love to be able to serve like Ben Shelton, and I'm sure Ben Shelton would love to do everything else like Rafa on a clay court. All right, speaking of that Monte Carlo, let's go back to that because we did see Novak Djokovic get to the semifinals, playing good tennis along the way. You know, somewhat of an uncharacteristic loss in my mind to Casper Ruud in the semifinal, 6-3 in the third. Matt, you don't think much of that loss or that it means too much with regard to how we should view Novak going into the French Open, though.
No, I don't think so. I was actually really pleased that he won a couple of matches. He played, I mean, he got to the semis, so he won three matches. He played good enough to me. And the way that he lost to Casper Ruud, he's going to get better and better and better. I don't think Novak needs to win clay court tournaments to feel like or to be the favorite at the French Open. I do think he needs some matches, and he got that already. He looked fit. He looked strong. I think him losing to Casper Ruud, this is not something that guys do voluntarily, but it's sometimes in the back of your mind that, okay, I'm going to try and win this match by, for example, serving and volleying in the last service game for Novak, going for a big second serve on match point down, losing. Would he do that at the French Open? No, he wouldn't. So I think he's searching a little bit for what am I going to do on a clay this year? Play aggressive, play defense. Am I strong enough physically? I think it was a perfect start. He doesn't want to rack up two or three clay court tournament wins. Then the pressure is immense. Not that he can't handle it. If I was Novak and if I was helping him or working with him, I'd say that was the absolute perfect start for the clay court season.
Johnny, before we go to break, we've talked about Novak, and if you're going to get him, you're going to get him best of three, much more so than you're going to get him best of five. But from a surface perspective, is it safe to say that Novak's advanced level of experience and an advanced level of wisdom probably holds up better on clay at this point than almost any other surface just because of the grinding nature of winning at the French Open?
You know, Andy, I don't think so.
Okay.
I agree with Matt. I think he in a big five-set match, I think he beats Ruud. I still think he beats Tsitsipas. But I think Alcaraz and Sinner are going to be pretty good favorites. I just think these guys get so many balls back. I think his best chance for a slam is going to be on grass.
Okay.
But when you look at what he did in Monte Carlo, to Matt's point, he's playing very solid still on clay. I mean, he did have the loss to Ruud, but again, he's going to get up for the bigger, for the slams. He beat Safelin, he beat Musetti, he beat Damanar. I mean, these are really good wins on clay. So he's going to be in top form at the French. I just think it's going to be tough for him to get through Alcaraz and Sinner on the dirt.
All right. Well, we're going to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to the great Alex Querecha, a French Open finalist in his own right, one of the great Spaniards of all time. And we're going to find out exactly what we should expect from Carlos Alcaraz, from Rafael Nadal, because if anybody knows, Mats Wilander, about what's going on in the Spanish Federation, it is Alex Querecha. Johnny will be back in the third segment. We got some good stuff to talk about there as well. You're listening to KickServeRadio.com, part of Tennis Channel Podcast Network. The great Alex Querecha joins KickServeRadio.com for the very first time, so don't go away.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome back, everybody. KickServeRadio.com, part of Tennis Channel Podcast Network. And as promised, we are very excited to, for the very first time, be able to bring on the show the great Alex Querecha. He is a teammate of Matt's at Eurosport. And Alex, I'd like to start by A, welcoming you, and B, I want to ask you a question before I let Matt talk to you about some things that are happening in today's current tennis, and that is talking about your own career. You know, you were part of that great Spanish Armada, and sometimes people get maybe a little bit confused about who did what. And when you look back and you realize, okay, the two French Open finals and winning the ATP Tour Championships, winning the Italian Open, beating Marcelo Rios in the final. But would it be fair to say that when you've got a little grandkid on your knee and you're telling him about your career, you're going to say, you know what, your grandpa actually was one of the few players in the history of the sport to have a winning record over Roger Federer?
Well, it's a good start. It's a good start. Thank you, Andy. And then, you know how much I appreciate not just the record, but being here with you, especially, I mean, you, Andy, of course. But for me, being next to Matt, it's a gift. Every day I'm with him at Eurosport. Every time, I have the chance to talk to him. It's not because he's in front of me, but I told him many times, I consider him like a little bit of an older brother. My family all knows him. They all love Matt. So imagine for me being here. And about my grandkids, I didn't think about it. I have to say, my winning record, it was also in favor against Nadal.
Uh-huh.
So it was against Federer and it was against Nadal. So
oh,
we're talking about
goodness.
Records. Yes. Of course, he was quite young, but it's a record, let's say.
Yeah. I have to say, Alex, when the clay court season comes around, it is nowhere I want to be more than playing the clay court season, watching the clay court season. And in the last 15, 18 years, the clay court season has become completely different from what it used to be because of your countryman, Rafael Nadal. Of course, mm-hmm. He played this week in Barcelona. I know you're there, Alex. You're commentating. You most probably even had a chance to speak to Rafa during the week. But what's the temperature on Spanish tennis right now with Rafa trying to play for another year? Carlos Alcaraz he's injured again. He pulled out of Barcelona and Monte Carlo, of course. Where is tennis in Spain right now in terms of excitement?
Well, it's huge because, you know, it's springtime. You know, we're in Barcelona now playing the tournament. And you know very well that tournament. You know, every time we see like the Miami Open is finishing, we start feeling like goosebumps about feeling like the clay coming into our shoes, into our socks, you know. And the spectators here in Barcelona, they are so excited because they always know that some of the Spanish guys are going to do well. Of course, we lost Alcaraz before the tournament started. Then Nadal lost in the second round against Damanor. But still, we have the feeling like the players in Spain, they know how to deal with the clay court stuff, you know, the patience, the sliding, the spin, you know, the suffering, the sweating. And you can feel that when you go into the Real Club Tennis Barcelona. You know, everybody feels so passionate about watching tennis. And you know what? That's, I feel, in my opinion, that that's the best tennis you can see on clay. The guys, they need to do something different. They need to think. They need to change heights. They need to just figure out how to play, not just to hit bombs, you know? So that's how we feel in Barcelona. Of course, when you don't have like a big king going into the last rounds, maybe you're missing something, but there are all the guys that are doing great. And we love tennis in Spain. We love tennis in Barcelona. So whoever is going to win through the weekend is going to be nice.
Alex, if I may, a lot of people have compared your game very favorably to mine. And by a lot of people, I mean nobody ever. But except for one thing, is that we both sport, in your case, a spectacularly beautiful one-hander. And in my case, at least I try to hit a one-hander reasonably well. And now here we are. We went through a lull where we had no one-handers in the top 10. Then Grigor does well at Miami, breaks back in. Then Tsitsipas in Monte Carlo. Now we've got two. Have you shown a little bit of like minor depression about the fact that the one-hander is being rendered as almost extinct at this point?
Well, a little bit, because at the end of the day, you know, one-handed backhand, in my opinion, is more stylish. You know, it's, I mean, it's much more elegant. I would say you have more class when you play one-handed backhand. You can mix it up as well, height. You move your wrist much better. Usually you have even a better volley when you are one-handed backhand. And of course, I have to say that, I feel like it's going to be difficult for guys to keep on playing one-handed backhand because you need to be extremely good. Because nowadays they play so fast, they play so deep, so long, that it's so difficult to control with one-handed backhand because you go backwards most of the time. When the ball, they serve kick out wide to your backhand, it's so tough. You need to go far back in order to play behind your shoulder, you know. And when the ball is going short, it's difficult to just step in and hit with one-handed. While with two-handed, you can rotate your shoulders. You can put your right leg in front of you, and it's much easier. So when I see Dimitrov or Tsitsipas, which I think it was one of the improvements he made in Monte Carlo in order to win the tournament, his backhand, then you feel like, okay, still some musketeers left, that they play nice tennis and different than, let's say, with all the respect to all the other players, a little bit like more robots and machines hitting the ball as hard as they can, but is more effective, I would say.
Andy, that's when I feel like Alex lost respect here. You know, more robot-like. That's more like me, right? Like the sweet.
Yeah, no. I know what he said. You didn't hit the backhand as the guys these days, Matt. You were like sort of like pushing up, which it was fair enough, but not hitting the ball as hard as they do now.
Yeah. So, Alex, obviously, Rafa, we talked about a little bit. Rafa played in Barcelona. You commentated him. You also said you talked to him. Can you give us a little insight how do you think he played? Was it good enough? Was it long enough? And then his attitude and the personal connection you had with Rafa.
I would say I was quite impressed by the way he was hitting the ball. I think his backhand was great. I mean, he was hitting in the sweet spot. The ball was going fast out of his racket. I would say his forehand was working well. At points, he felt like maybe he was not fast enough to be behind the ball, and he was leaning a little bit backwards. So sometimes the ball was flying a little bit far away, but he was trying to dictate. He was trying to be aggressive. He also, of course, played with a lot of height. But I have to say, first, he was serving Matt and Andy. He was serving, 50% of his chances. You know, he was just using his arm, not using his abs, not nearly his legs. So he was like, it's so difficult. And you know, Matt, how do you serve 145 case, 150, let's say 160, and then next shot, you got to go and play 100% full speed? This is so difficult. This is something that I think for him, it was not easy. Then when he played long rallies, you can see that he was feeling well, maybe not as smooth, especially moving into the forehand side when they were crossing backhand short. Maybe he struggled a little bit there, but also you can see it's a little bit of lack of playing points and sets. And about talking with him, as you said, Matt, I had the chance to spoke twice on TV, let's say in an interview. And he was quite relaxed. He was even more relaxed than at the time that we spoke with him, like maybe a couple of years ago. He was more chill. I think he was a little bit relieved that he was back on court. And even when I spoke with him off camera and I had the chance to chat for a few minutes, he was very well. He was smiling. He was asking about me, my family, how's life going on, you know? So I felt like Rafa, he was quite fresh. And I was quite happy to see that he was enjoying himself. Well, I thought he was going to struggle a little bit, or suffer. But no, it was totally the opposite. So good news. Of course, he needs some more matches in order to be ready for, I mean, to damage a top player, let's say top 10 players.
When you look at the job, look, moving over to talking about Carlos Alcaraz, that that Juan Carlos Ferrero is doing with him, what do you think the next steps are? We've seen what Darren Cahill has done for Jannik Sinner, and we've seen some substantial improvements, particularly at Australia and ever since. And it sounds like those two guys are going to really push each other on a go forward. Alex, what is Juan Carlos going to need to do, or what has he told you he's going to do to continue to have Carlos be able to keep pace with Jannik?
Well, I think they are quite different in a way, Carlos and Jannik. I think Carlos is way more creative. He loves to enjoy every time he steps on the court. It seems like he likes to have fun. I think he's learning to know how to have fun and at the same time just be practical to win matches, you know, because sometimes you don't need to have fun, you just need to win. I think what Jannik does better than Carlitos, I would say, is that he doesn't really care if he's hitting the ball great or not. He's just there to do his job. And what Juan Carlos is trying to tell Carlitos Alcaraz is being himself, try to be aggressive most of the time, trying to dictate with his forehand, try to be creative as well. But I think they're also learning, especially from last year after he won Wimbledon, and this year, the beginning of the year, when he lost, especially against Zverev, I would say, at the Australian Open, that not every single match you're going to go there and everything is going to be like a show. You know, you need to understand that you're not a rock star. And if you're a tennis player, and Matt knows better than me for sure, you know how you need to know how to win matches, even if you feel so bad, even if you feel like, okay, today I'm just going to run and I'm going to win no matter what. And this is something that I think Carlitos is learning to do, without losing, of course, his, you know, his instincts, his basics, you know. While I think Sinner, he's improving his game. He's, you know, having more variation. But now he's going to be so difficult to beat because he is like a real machine that he's not going to give you anything left.
Mm. When you obviously talking about both of them, Rafa Nadal, one of the maybe the best competitor in professional sports. Certainly, I think the best competitor in tennis, in men's tennis. That's pretty much for sure. And then you have Carlos Alcaraz. Just because because I'm not sure myself, and you would know the answer. Just because it looks like Alcaraz is enjoying himself more in terms of his expressions than Rafa. Sometimes with Rafa, I wonder what part of it does he enjoy so much? Obviously, the competitive part. With Carlitos, having his attitude, does he have the same strength in terms of competing as Rafael Nadal? It just looks completely different. Or is he going to, not physically, in his mind, sometimes throw in matches where, you know what, more like like I did, or like McEnroe did. Well, you know what, I don't feel that good. I'm just going to have fun. I'll go and play some golf in the next 2 days. With Rafa, you never had that feeling. Where is Carlos in terms of the necessity to win matches? It's nearly an addiction to someone like Nadal or Djokovic. And to me, to a certain point, and you to a certain point, but Carlitos is so different.
Yeah, I think he is from a totally different generation, which they feel like everything has to happen much faster, you know, and everything has to be even more fun in order to enjoy what's going on. And you know how difficult it is to do that in tennis every day, and especially every tournament, and especially changing surfaces, changing opponents, you know. That's very difficult because one day you feel good, next day you play night session, and all of a sudden, everything changes. And you feel like, oh, how am I going to have fun today if I don't really feel the ball? Okay, I'm just going for it. I think that's the point that we need to see in the upcoming years, if Carlitos is able to or willing to say, okay, I'm not going to lose the way I am, but there are days where maybe I need just to say, okay, I want to win no matter what. I want to die. I want to kill to win this match. Does he have this desire? I'm not so sure, because I think he prioritizes maybe to play well or to have more fun, even sometimes I'm winning, while when you have Rafa, you know that he kills and he dies to win tennis matches. And then if he has fun, it's unbelievable. And I'm going to tell you something. I remember talking to Rafa many years ago when he won maybe his fifth or sixth Roland Garros. And I said to him, wow, what a great match you played today in the finals. And he said to me, yeah, it's pretty much the first time I felt like I was playing very good tennis here at Roland Garros. And I'm like, okay, but what do you mean? And he said, yeah. Because the other, I don't know, five or six times I won, I felt that I was playing so-so, but not great. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, he's going to win at least 10. And he won 14 because he had this mentality, you know? So this is the difference between Carlitos and Rafa. They're different. I mean, they're different, as I said before, different generations, different styles of games, different. Okay, we are all Spanish, but one is from Mallorca, the other one is from Murcia. You know, it's different kind of culture as well, even if you are in the same country.
Yeah, Andy, I'm going to let you have a word in here. I'm just going to try to explain something to our listeners that I think is misunderstood sometimes. And if it's wrong, Alex, then you can tell me right now, live on the spot. They always talked about the Spanish way of playing tennis. And then someone who didn't really know the game would throw in, well, you know, they all play on clay and they're clay court specialists and blah, blah. And I'm like, no, hold on a second. That is the exact opposite of Spanish temperament, the Spanish tennis. What Spanish tennis had and has and will have is great attitude, and the guys will always get the most out of their game. Even someone like Feliciano Lopez on a clay court will do what he can. David Ferrer on any surface will do what he... I mean, that's... We thought you were all clay court specialists. David Ferrer is most probably better on hard courts. But what they are so good, Alex, and it's you and the guys around you, Carlos Moya, Albert Costa, and you would know these guys if they had a great attitude all the time. But the attitude of a Spanish tennis player, that's why I think kids want to go to Spain and train there to get some of that feeling that the Spanish players has. True or not true?
Absolutely true. I mean, I think we need to separate two things here. You can be a clay court specialist. Yes, you are a clay court specialist, but that doesn't mean that you are a clay court player. Clay court player is different than clay court specialist. You can be a grass court specialist, but that doesn't mean that you cannot play maybe well on hard courts. But if they tell you, oh, if you don't play on, you don't know how to play tennis, you are useless, then it's when I start getting upset, you know? And the mentality of the Spanish people and culture, and especially in tennis, it's like, yeah, I want you to give you 100%, okay? I don't care how you feel. I don't care if you don't feel your backhand today or your serve or your forehand. No, I'm not putting first serves in because I'm not hitting aces. Okay, you're not hitting aces. Just give me 65% of kicks inside the court and run. Yeah, but I'm just running today. And your coach is telling you, I don't give a shit if you're just running. I want you to win. I want you to suffer, you know. And then tomorrow, maybe you feel better. This is a little bit the mentality, you know. And that's why when you see someone like David Ferrer or myself, that you gave everything you had. And then, yeah, I feel like, why I didn't win that 2 Roland Garros final? Well, because I lost to someone like Moya or Quertin, that they had more strength, a better forehand, a better serve. But I don't regret it. I'm going to go to sleep tonight and I'm going to feel like, guys, I did what I could. You know, it's not like, oh, if I would have done this or that. No, I'm just feel happy from what I did, because that's what I had inside me. That's why I keep calm and I'm happy with my life, you know, because my conscience is calm, I would say.
That's exactly, if I may, Matt, why, in my opinion, Patrick McEnroe, when he was the head of U.S. player development, went to Spain to study the Spanish way, to find out why the Spaniards were playing with so much more heart than the American players were at that time. And I think you wanted to try to dive into all of what you just described there, Alex. Now, while you guys were talking, I jotted something down because now I'm going to have a little fun here. You guys are both Davis Cup champions and both took Davis Cup very seriously. And your countries that you represent are both steeped in such great Davis Cup tradition. So I put down a fantasy Davis Cup match, and I'm going to let you handicap this, Alex. I'm going to let you have the first word. Representing Sweden, I've got Bjorn Borg, Mats Wilander, Stefan Edberg, and because he was such a pain in Nadal's ass, I've got Robin Soderling on that team as well. Versus Rafael Nadal, Carlitos, Carlos Moya, and yourself. Mm. Who are the singles players? What's the doubles team, and who wins that thing?
Oh, God damn. I mean,
start with doubles, Alex, please.
Listen, I won a bronze medal in Sydney with Albert Costa in doubles. So, I mean, I know
that's
you won Wimbledon, which, yeah. But which surface do we play and where do we play? Do we play in Sweden or we play?
I'm going to say it's going to be on clay on a neutral court.
In Sweden, yeah, that would be the most fair surface. It's indoors, so Edberg could play, okay. But it's clay, blah, okay. Blah, blah. Yes, yeah. Indoors in Sweden. And we never lost indoors in Sweden on clay, by the way.
Well, I mean, I feel like definitely we need to go with Carlitos. Let's say we play best of five, okay? Because at the end of the day, it's what we used to play that way.
Back in the day.
I think we need to go all the way with Rafa and probably Alcaraz right away. I would pretty much feel like Moya and I, you know what? We were not too good combining together when we played doubles. I felt like Moya never really liked it to play so much in doubles, which I think he could do well, but he was not in his area, you know? So I might play doubles with Rafa in the second day. And I would say also maybe Moya and Alcaraz for the last day, you know, because I think Moya, he loved to play under pressure. He loved those conditions. And if Rafa is capable to give you a couple of points first day and second day, and then you have Alcaraz, the magic Carlos, you know, Carlos Alcaraz or Carlos Moya, and we will have another one. So I think we will make it 2-3.
Mm. All right, Mats, what are you doing with the Swedish team?
Well, I have to say that my dear friend Bjorn would definitely get to play singles. Although, of course, in our day, Alex, it wasn't number one versus number one the first day or number two. It was just a draw. Anyone could play anyone the first day. I would not want to see Bjorn play against Rafa Nadal. Mm. I think I would throw Robert Söderling into that singles because this is a match we're not going to win. We just want to hurt Rafa enough in singles so that maybe he doesn't want to play doubles and maybe he feels a little. So Söderling against Nadal for sure. And then I would throw Bjorn in against Carlos Alcaraz because I think that there's not a single player in the world that can hit drop shots to win five sets against Bjorn Borg. No chance. He is so fast. So that would be it. And then, of course, I would throw me and Stefan in doubles because we played a lot of Davis Cup doubles. He won majors in doubles. I won Wimbledon. We are from the same state. And then you'll see the last day. I mean, maybe you throw in Edberg against Nadal because maybe the surface by now is fast. He can kick the serve, come to the net. Rafa is returning all the way in a different country. So I think we feel like we have a good chance of winning, but I believe we have 24 singles majors between us. And I believe Rafa and Carlitos, they have 24 too. No, Moya has one.
That's right.
So Spain wins very close. Wow.
That is a fantasy match indeed. And it has been a fantasy guest having the great Alex Kurecha on with us today. Alex, thank you so much. Continued success with everything that you're doing representing Eurosport. And for everything that you said about how much you enjoy working with the great Mats Wilander, he has mentioned the exact same thing to us on numerous occasions on how much he enjoys working with you and how highly he thinks of your work. So I think it's definitely mutual admiration between the two of you, without a doubt.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Andy. It's been a pleasure. And Mats, You know, I love you from the deepest part of my heart. So hope to see you very soon, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much. He is the great Alex Kurecha. When we come back, Johnny Levine will join us again. And Johnny's upset about something, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. Instead of doing Johnny's hot list, we're doing Johnny's hot button when we come back on kickserveradio.com, part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network.
Hi guys, Sarah Z here with a Kick Serve Quick Serve with my friend and nutrition guru, Courtney Ward with Body Fuse. Courtney, as we ladies start to get, oh, shall I say, more advanced or more experienced in our life, how about just body weight and body maintenance? That for me is becoming, I think, tougher by the day.
Boy, you're not alone. And along with our sports performance line, Body Fuse also offers a full weight loss line. And we have a fantastic product called Purify, which kickstarts your weight loss. It's a GI detox. It's a water cut as well. So it's really great for bloating, irregularity, and people love it to kickstart a weight loss program. And then with that, we couple a product called Blackwall Shredded, kind of cool name. It's a daytime thermogenic and also has a nootropic in it. It's not super high stimulant, but it's just a good mental focus. And it just basically kickstarts your metabolic rate. So that's a daytime thermogenic. We also offer a nighttime thermogenic called Midnight Burn. And this has melatonin and GABA as well as a thermogenic. So it kind of continues that metabolic rate bump, if you will. So that these three products are sort of like the magic trinity. I don't want to say magic pills because there's no such thing, but Midnight Burn at night, Blackwall Shredded in the day, and then Purify to kind of kickstart your system and clean out your GI tracts. And in addition, Purify, along with the detox, it allows us to start absorbing nutrients a little bit more efficiently as well. So those three products are just a fantastic trio and very, very popular.
Fantastic. And one more time, Body Fuse,
bodyfuseusa.com.
Well, I'm Sarah Z. She's Courtney with Body Fuse. And now back to more tennis talk with the Kick Serve Radio boys.
Welcome back, everybody. KickServeRadio.com, part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Want to thank Alex Kurecha one more time for joining us. Matt's great job lining him up. He is so great. And oftentimes, when we get to the end of the show, we do Johnny's Hot List, but there's not a lot going on in the Challenger world right now. So we're going to do, instead of the Johnny's Hot List, we're going to do Johnny's Hot Button. And I know what it is. Johnny, you have been really frustrated with what you perceive to be too much being made of some of these great players taking a loss at one of these tournaments, and suddenly you feel as though, whether it's Matt and myself or people on other podcasts or whatever the case may be, making a little too much out of these week-to-week losses, and maybe you feel as though people don't necessarily feel the gravity of how deep this men's field is from 1 to 100.
Yeah, I do feel pretty strongly about that, Andy, and what I'm really talking about is, first of all, for a guy like Djokovic, who clearly has the most slams of anyone at 24, he's really looking to win slams now. And he's playing week in, week out, a lot of tournaments. And the guys are just, they're so good and they're so ready to beat Novak. Like, I guess Rude, the win for him at Monte Carlo is something he'll be able to tell his grandkids one day, that he beat maybe the greatest player of all time, which it looks like he might go down as being that. But he's really preparing himself every week throughout the year for the slams. So he knows he's not going to win every tournament. He knows he's going to lose to guys. And I just think that, like you said, the margin between these players is so razor thin. You know, you just go down the list, you know, Zverev and Rud and Tsitsipas and Rublev and Medvedev and Alcaraz and Sinner. I mean, all these guys on any given day, and even guys outside of the top 10, the margin is thin. So he's going to have his losses, just like Alcaraz is going to have his losses, and same with Sinner. So it really comes down to the slams and guys peaking at the right time. And that's where they don't want to lose to the guy that's, you know, 60 in the world. or 40 in the world or 30 in the world. So I think that's where people have to understand that they're going to lose throughout the year. And the key for these guys is really the slams.
All right. So, Mass, here's what I want to say is that, first of all, compared to the way I got it handed to me on the phone when we weren't on the air by this guy the other day, that was unbelievably tame and unbelievably mild. And I'm trying to think of why is it that Johnny takes this so personally? And I think I have it figured out. It's two reasons. A, he's like, I was 100 in the world and I deserve that kind of respect. And I was trying and we were all really good. And Johnny, we know that.
No,
we know that, we get it. And then, yes. And the second thing is, and all these guys in my tournament that come to Arizona that are ranked between 15 and 100 in the world, they're damn good too. And you better know it. And so I think that's where this is all coming from. I don't know. Johnny, am I wrong?
Andy, okay. We didn't even talk about Fritz Shelton and Rune and Damonar. I mean,
I said 1 through 100. I mean, I included everybody.
I just think that, As Matt knows, I mean, everyone is losing every week. There's only one winner. And, you know, the depth is incredible. What we had with Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic, and you can even put Murray in there for a while, was something that I don't know that we'll ever see again.
Okay, so Matt, let's look back on your glory days back in the 80s and into the 90s. If you went to these majors and you had the top players in the world, did you guys feel the same way about the depth of the field then that we should feel about it now? This is just a modern day version of it. Was it as deep? Could a guy top five in the world lose to a guy ranked between 75 and 100 in the world, or was it a little bit more unheard of?
Well, you know what? I can go two ways with this, honestly, because with the big three, you have these unbelievably one-sided head-to-head records where someone like Marin Cilic, who's made two Grand Slam finals, Wimbledon and Australian Open, and he won the US Open, and his head-to-head with Novak is something like 119. Okay, that never happened in our day.
Okay.
Yes, a lot has to do with the surfaces, that a faster court suited the serve and volley and so on. So, you know, I sometimes I have to go and look at it. They are easily the three best players of all time, 100% for sure. Why is it that it's been so one-sided when it comes to not within the three, but compared and playing against the rest of the top 100? Way more one-sided than it was in the 80s. So I can go both ways. What I do will say that physically, the guys in the top 100 are way closer to the big three than they were in our day in terms of technique, in terms of even stamina in certain situations. Like, there wasn't many guys that I felt that I can't hang with in terms of stamina. And I think today the top 100, I mean, the strongest man in the world could be a guy ranked 80 in the world these days. He just doesn't have the weapons. So I think that these guys have pushed each other so hard and so far that they have reached levels that McEnroe is one that could have dreamt of it, because he had 1 year in 1984 where he only lost two matches. I won three majors in 88, but I won a couple of more tournaments, but it wasn't the domination that Novak has. So I think that we do make a lot about Novak losing, and I do think that it's not there's a question mark. It's more, to me, when I say it, it's more, it gives the other players some hope. Hey, look, Novak lost. And what do we want to see more than anything? Competitive tennis, competitive matches, because it makes it better.
Okay, guys, before we check out, it's the clay court season. I think your clay court record, Matt, speaks for itself. People don't necessarily realize how well, for an American player in his day, Johnny's game translated to a clay court. So I'm going to ask you both, give me 1 minute, Johnny, best clay court win as a pro.
For me.
For you, yeah. Yeah, not just for anybody. You don't want mine. Mine was at Onion Creek in Austin in 1985. I beat Julio Rojas in the final. It was a pretty big win for me. So I'll throw that in. But for you guys, where it actually was like pro tennis as opposed to my stuff.
I always thought that, you know, I had looked up to Harold Solomon on clay. And when I beat Solomon at the U.S. clay courts in Boston, that was a pretty big win for me at the time.
You beat him pretty good too, didn't you?
I did, but
3-1,
something like that.
Wow.
I had a couple other good results, but that's the one that comes to mind right now.
Levine over Solly. It sounds like it could have been played just right outside of a Passover service. But anyway, Johnny gets the better of him and beats him 3-1. And he got the Offie Coleman. All right. So Mats, I mean, obviously there's so many and we've talked about a few of them, but I mean, is it Vilas in the French in 82?
No, it isn't.
No.
It's very, very clear to me. It was against Ivan Lendl in 1985 at the finals of the French. I beat Ivan a couple of times on clay in 82, French Open, fourth round, Barcelona. And then he started getting me on hard courts. He always was better than me. And we played in the finals of the French Open. And it was Lendl, big favorite, of course. But something clicked that day. I changed my style, and I didn't realize that was the way that I was going to start playing more and more and more, which was coming to the net a lot more. I just never done it on the clay court. So to me, I wasn't good enough to just play clay court tennis the way I did in 1982 against Guillermo Vilas. Lendl was much better than Guillermo Vilas was in 85 than Vilas was in 82, I think, at least more dangerous. But to me, it's Lendl on clay. It was always the guy. Ivan is where I had my best wins. But can I throw something into you guys? So American. So I played Mal Purcell, finals of Monte Carlo. I don't know what he did at the French Open that year. Jimmy Arias, finals of Monte Carlo. I'm not sure. I always felt that the Americans, somehow there was always one guy that showed up that was, and the reason I bring up Johnny, someone like you, like a Lawson Duncan or a Terry Moore. Remember Terry Moore got to the fourth round of the French. There's always someone, Jimmy Brown, that an American guy that did okay in the clay court season, but at the French, suddenly he came sort of alive. And I love those Cinderella stories with the Americans that you know, third round, fourth round, maybe even a quarters at the French Open. To me, that is so cool, and it's so unexpected. So I can't wait to see Americans and Ben Shelton winning there. I think it's a massive, massive boost for American clay court tennis.
Michael Russell comes to mind. Oh. Didn't he have match points on Guga in the fourth round? Got to the fourth round and had Guga, you know, by the short hairs and then
five
let
sets.
It get away. Yeah, good five setters. So we want to, as Brad Gilbert refers to him, make mention of the Michael Russell, the Jack Russell Terrier, because that's probably exactly what he was like playing on those clay courts. All right, that's all we got tonight, you guys. It's so great being back with Mats and Johnny. Again, want to thank Alex Karecha for joining us. If we're talking French Open and we're talking Alcaraz and Rafa, who better to talk about it with than Alex Karecha? Great job on that. For the great Mats Wielander, Texas Longhorn, two-time All-American Johnny Levine. I'm Andy Zodin. We're kickserveradio.com. We are part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Enjoy the dirt, everybody, and we'll be talking to you soon.